Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
Whoa! Guys, keep calm and read your Dickens.
PJ, we're using the Anna Karenina method here.
He's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The one and only.
This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Books.
We did it. We actually did the intro correctly.
Oh, we did the intro. But I am still very much confused about what Biblos, books, hun, what it's all about, or known as Knigi and Skanske. Oh. There's so many different words, but it's an abstract concept. What is that?
If you look at my teacup here, you'll see we've got, I believe, some books on the teacup. Right, so, but I can't read them. I'm struggling to open them. That's the problem.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's like, where is it? You know, like trying to read the walls, trying to read between the, you know, that's where the phrase comes. Trying to read between the lines, and it's like I'm trying to read between the lines of like the pavement cracks, and like I see stuff on the table, like, you know, lines. So it's like, yeah, I'm trying to read it, but it's difficult.
I saw a big crack in the plaster in the wall when I was going to a car park, and I just tried to read in there. I got some dust in my face, man. It wasn't good.
I thought that's what The Alchemist, you know what I mean? It's supposed to be a good play, and I was trying to read that between the cracks in the wall, yeah. Anyway.
Should mention also we're joined by Little Alfred. There he is.
Yeah, he's there. I thought he went money laundering one day and just left us behind. He wasn't there one show, and I was thinking, okay, did he take all that Patreon money?
He did take all the Patreon money, to be fair. But he also likes his holidays as much as we do. That's the thing, you know, his mandatory vacation time. But since we mentioned it, guys, go to the Patreon, patreon.com/booksboys. You can get this show early. You can also get Playboys, all the back catalogue. Plus, we're doing Playboys of Attica now with Alex. We're going to talk about some Greek comedies and tragedies. You can get Film Fellows, Caper Captains, Music Men, all sorts of things on there. So go and check out the Patreons. And it's like $3, or it's like a cup of coffee, or, you know.
Exactly. And contribute. And then we'd love to do more. And And there's some exciting stuff happening in the horizon. So just keep a lookout. Mm-hmm. We want to release a few episodes for free, so you can
them. Anyone subscribed to the podcast feed will notice that some of the older episodes from like a year and a half ago, you know, we're going to release those slowly for free just to get you kind of caught up and more people can hear them. But there's so much more on the Patreon, so you need to go and check that out. You don't want to wait a year to hear what we thought about Aristophanes, you know?
Exactly, yeah. But we started off because this was supposed to help GCSE students with Shakespeare. So we restarted off with Shakespeare and tried to help, you know, the young kids with their exams, you know.
With Guillermo Shakespeare.
Shakespeare. I suppose we also wanted to make it attractive to the new generation. Because I think Shakespeare is still, old Billy is still the hit, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I should mention I went to the Lyric Theatre in Belfast 2 weeks ago. And I saw Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, wow.
I never actually saw it performed before. I thought it was fantastic. It was a semi-modernization. Like, they used the original dialogue and a set, but then they used, like, some modern music and costumes. So, I don't know why, but it kind of worked out well. Like, I thought it was very good. I thought the acting was superb. And the dramatic,
still using,
conclusion.
Still using Middle English. I mean, yes. Shakespearean. No, okay, that's good. But it was a modern setting. I enjoyed that as well. And I like the Lyric Theatre. They're very into that in Belfast. They would do very... I think I once saw St. Joan by Bernard Shaw
Ooh.
And they were playing it, I think, in an office setting, but it worked. So, I mean, it's nice to be experimental. But
yeah. And I went a second time to the theater, to the Mac, to see an opera. So take out your middle class checklist and mark up a little mark there. I went to see an opera for the first time. Nice. And it was the Barber of Sevilla, which was fantastic.
Nice.
And it was you know, it was translated to English, but it was amazing.
Oh, it's translated to English. Yeah, but hold on a second. Is this the next Patreon thing? The opera boys. Yeah. The operettas.
That's what we're gonna do next. It was fantastic. I really, really loved it.
Nice.
Now what I need to do next is get a dedicated opera box, like all the chaps in Balzac's books, and you know, just have like your just rent it all year long, a box at the opera, and then you can give it to all the ladies in time and tell them to meet you in the opera, you know.
Exactly. That will work out. You can try it out.
Mm-hmm. And we're recording a little bit early this month because I'm going on a little trip to London. I'm going to go to the theater again to see Titus Andronicus with Playboy Alex and Dark Place Robert. So
you're addicted to the old theater. The theater, darling.
The theater. I am indeed. I love it. El Teatro. Now, a little secret. There used to be a lovely little place in Belfast called Teatro, but we'll leave that for a little Easter egg for the no one who will know what we're talking about.
Exactly. Good old theater. Yeah. Miss it.
Yeah.
Bit book.
I miss it as well.
What's it all about? And so we're not sure yet, but I hear you have been reading some books, a few books. May I guess there might be a Balzac, maybe a bit of.
Okay.
I don't know. Let's see what's in it. I'm guessing a Balzac and maybe a Galdós, but I genuinely don't know people. So let's hear.
Okay. You're wrong.
Didn't tell me this time.
I do have a Balzac queued up, though, for the next month or two. And I do have some more Spanish books, but this month I didn't read anything in Spanish, and I wanted to check in with some old friends, but not Balzac. He's next month. So we've got a certain Alexandre Dumas, and we've got Wilkie Collins.
I could have guessed those. Those were very nice choice. Well, he's not French, Dean. I mean, unless it's Debmon or whatever.
So I read five books, but I'm only going to talk about four of them, and I'll tell you why. The very first book, I mentioned it last month that I had just started it, and I kind of finished it very quickly. It was The Woods by Harlan Coben. And, you know, I think it's a Netflix series as well. People love this stuff. I saw Safe, which is another Harlan Coben series, on Netflix as well. And they're just your usual. It was a guilty pleasure for me. It was just a palate cleanser after all the classic stuff and the Spanish stuff.
Yeah.
You can read it in a couple of days. It's your usual, you know, thriller type scenario. Basically, these kids get killed in the woods many, many years ago, and this guy should have been looking after them as a kind of camp warden, or he was a kid himself, but he was put in charge of the, you know, looking out for them that night, guard duty or whatever.
And
they died on his watch, essentially, and one of them was his sister. And now there's a big conspiracy: well, are they really dead, or did they go missing? And then some things come back, you know, to haunt them from the grave. He finds a dead body and he says, "That's actually my friend who I thought died 20 years ago. What's going on?" And then that opens up like a whole big thing. He's also the county prosecutor, so there's like a legal case going on, and it all ties together. It's just one of those usual page turners. You flick through it, it keeps you hooked.
It's done. What's it called again?
It's called The Woods.
The Woods, okay.
Yeah. So you know the sort of thing that it is. I don't think I really need to, you know, give it a full review.
Sounding a bit Friday the 13th-esque, is there a bit of a Jason character?
Yeah, so the trick is you're meant to look after the kids, but you don't. You go skinny dipping naked for no reason at 4 a.m. in the pitch black, and then you get killed by a guy in a hockey mask. And it just inexplicably, you know?
Yeah, it's a formula, right? It's the Friday the 13th method. There we go.
That's it. So, I did read four other books that I'm going to talk about in a bit more detail. And the first one is our good friend, Alexandre Dumas. And I read a book which, well...
Right? Not the son. Yeah.
You know the score here. We don't know what the book is. So, my version is called Marguerite de Valois. Okay?
Right.
And this lovely little paperback. And I bought this. I think you were with me when I bought this.
Oh, my God. A year ago, yeah. We got
it's taken me that long to get through my endless queue of books. But this book is also known as La Reine Margot, the Queen Margot.
okay.
And for a while in English, it was actually released anonymously. They didn't know it was by Dumas, or it was disguised that it was by Dumas. So I don't know why these little details always come up, but it's 1845, and it's set in Paris, obviously, during the reign of, I believe, Charles the X. So if you've ever watched the TV series Reign on Netflix, you'll see, you'll know some of the characters from this. So we have Charles, we have Catherine de' Medici, and she's the villain of the book. So Catherine de' Medici's fantastic. She's this ultimate femme fatale. She's going around with poisonous perfumes and, you know, books that are poisonous to anyone who touches them and reads them, and trap doors in the floor, and, you know, trying to kill her own relatives and all this kind of stuff.
That's a nice thing to do.
It's not, kind of like, but she's fantastic. And I think that she's depicted very well by Dumas.
Okay, I got
you. I'm going to focus on the romance, and I know that's going to be a shock to you, PJ.
Well, very shocked. I wasn't expecting that.
There is some political stuff.
The things coming out here, Dumas, and you focusing on romantic, this is very unexpected. It's very a twist turn.
Right? You would never have thought so. The backdrop is this political maneuverings, and there's this big issue with the Catholics versus the Huguenots, who were French Protestants. So there is religious and political underpinnings, but I kind of didn't really care about that. I was just like, so do they fall in love? You know? So
important.
We have Henry of Navarre.
That's all about, isn't it, Dean? Even it's not the focus of the plot. It's just for you. It's just about, are they going to fall in love or not?
Yeah, it is, right? That's all I care about. So
fair enough. It's important.
It is. It is indeed. So Marguerite marries the King of Navarre, Henry. Right. Now, Navarre is, of course, Nevada in Spain. Where Pamplona is. So I don't know why France was controlling it at this time, but France was controlling it at this time.
Wait, when was this again? It's set in the... That's what I want to know.
Ooh, well, it was written in 1854. I don't know what time it was set in you'll have to forgive me. When did Well, I can tell you now. I'll just Google Marguerite Valois, because she was real.
If, as far as I know, like, France, you know, they take over Spain for a few years in the 19th century beginning.
But looks I thought this like... story... Okay, no, so 1589. That is when she became Queen of Navarre, became the Queen of France.
Right. Well, anyway, yeah, okay. I'm not well-versed enough in history, but okay. But just so you know, like, Dumas did take a lot of license with kind of history. So you can't really rely on that necessarily. But okay, so France taking over Navarre, but Navarre, yeah.
And that's not really even part of the story. It's just assumed that they have Navarre. Like, the book isn't about them trying to capture it or anything like that. They've already got it.
Yeah.
And Henry of Navarre is the king there, but he's not allowed to go there. He has to stay at the French court and be subservient to King Charles. Okay. But then there's another Henry, who's Charles's brother, and really the mother, Catherine de Medici, wants him to be king. And then there's a third brother, and it's a lot of, you know, politicking and faffing about. But they, at one point, they send one of the brothers off to Poland, and he's so heartbroken that he's leaving France for what he considers, you know, the wilds, like, you know, the kind of the Wild West, Poland, the savages, you know, and he's sending me to the other end of the world. It's like an hour on the train now or something, you know. So they sent him to be king of Poland or something at one point.
That's a tragedy. So he's being made king of Poland, and he's complaining.
They put him in charge, but he feels that it's a kind of exile, which it is an exile. They want him all away from France so he doesn't take his brother's throne.
Okay.
You know, but the King of Navarre, he's there. He marries Marguerite Valois. It's a marriage. It's a political marriage, and it's a combination of the Catholics and the Huguenots. And essentially what happens now is the husband and wife do not love each other or really care for each other at all. But they make a pact to at least be civil and to look after each other's interests as friends, even though they're not in love. And he has a mistress, and that's fine. And she just lets that go, you know. And to be fair, they're pretty true to each other. Henry of Navarre is the good guy. He does event, you know, he will become king if you look at your history. But he's the only person Charles can trust. And at one point, Charles says, you know, no one loves me apart from Henry. He says, my wife doesn't love me. His wife doesn't even appear in the novel. She's mentioned twice. She doesn't appear. She's so irrelevant. My mother doesn't love me because she's always plotting and scheming murders and, you know, disregarding my authority as king. The only person who really cares for me is Henry of Navarre, who actually stops an assassination attempt on King Charles. So even though they almost kill Henry because of his religion, because they think he's kind of king of the Huguenots. They think he's going to help rebellion. So all this kind of stuff is going on. And I'm not going to talk too much, as I say, about the religious aspect of it. But basically, there's just murders going on. Charles is sending people in to get murdered left, right, and center because of the religious aspects, you know?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So the best part is the two chaps. Yeah, there's a chap called Coconus and there's a chap called La Mole. Ooh. And this is very Three Musketeers-esque. They turn up at an inn and they're just these two like hapless guys. I think they are counts. They're like kind of low level aristocracy or whatever. And they've been sent on missions to opposing camps within France, one to the Catholics, one to the Huguenots. But they make friends in the inn and they decide to be friends. And then, you know, as the book goes on, they discover that they're really enemies and then they become friends again. And you know, there's a cycle. But they become such firm friends that they're all this strong platonic love, that they're in love with them even more than they're in love with their women.
Right.
You know? And of course,
romance, yeah.
Yeah. To add to that, one of them falls in love with Marguerite de Valois.
That's
and another falls in love with her best friend. And now they're on opposing sides because their men are on opposing sides. But then they all come together and it's a bit of, you know, the women bringing everyone together. The men are worried about their politics and the women are just like, let's think about the love and the friendship and all be friends. So there's a little bit of that in there as well.
Okay.
And it's fantastic. And Coconus and La Mole, the way they get on together, it's very D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers style.
Yeah, you like that, yeah.
And yeah, I mean...
You were disappointed that Love the Other Novel just didn't have that at all, right? So you were... This is a nice kind of reminder of that Dumas side.
It is. And I would say this is the best Dumas I've read in a long time.
Oh, nice. Okay, go.
No, I am worried because it has 7 sequels. So oh, I can see it fast going downhill.
Oh Lord, okay. Are you going to try reading or?
Well, I have one of them, so I might try it. It's called Chico the Jester.
Yeah, but just make sure it's not part 4, isn't it?
It's part 2. I have part 2, and then after that, we'll see.
We'll see. We'll see in the next 7 episodes.
But the way these two chaps get on together, you know, it's just fantastic. They want to help each other. There's nice dramatic. There's a scene where one of them is in, and he's being stabbed or whatever. He's bleeding. And he falls on Marguerite, the queen, you know, the Queen of Navarre, and she's got blood, and she hides it in a cupboard from the guys pursuing her. And it's just all these kind of big dramatic set pieces, you know, and she falls in love with him. But of course, even though her husband has a mistress, it wouldn't have been proper for her to take a male, you know, an affair, a lover. So she has to kind of hide that.
But hold on, she has a hidden affair or? She has an affair or just like a platonic kind of...
Well, it's not clear that they sleep together, but she does eventually admit that she loves him. And these guys, they'll do anything for love, you know, and that's their whole story is like, love is the only thing that matters. Like, I'll die right now as long as you tell me you love me and all this kind of stuff that I like. One of them's a little bit more romantic than the other. The other will sometimes be like, well, hold on, we do have some practical implications to take care of. Someone tried to murder me with a curtain around, you know, rope around my neck or whatever. Like, they're always kind of... One of them's a bit more practical than the other.
Yeah.
Nice. But the whole thing is just fantastic. And if you like your Dumas, if you like your Three Musketeers or anything like that, I would say this is definitely one to check out. There's a little scene during one of the murders I'm going to mention. This is the thing that reminds me of the Three Musketeers. He's going to pay his father's debt to this man, but he also has to kill the man. And he says, well, I've been ordered by my boss to kill him, but my father asked me to repay the debt. So I'm going to repay the debt first. You know, that's the honorable, gentlemanly thing to do. And then I'll kill him. And he goes in to do this. And they're begging and they're saying, don't kill us. Don't kill my little boy, my little Oliver or Olivier. Don't kill my little son as well. And then the son gets up and tries to attack him. So he has to kill the son and calls him a traitor. So there's a lot of drama. And I think, as I say, it's maybe not as good as The Three Musketeers or The Count of Monte Cristo. But it would be on a level with, say, The Black Tulip. You know, it's maybe that sort of B-tier book. A lot better, as I say, than some of the other ones that I've done.
Well, I didn't enjoy the other ones so much then.
Yeah, there was some that just weren't as good. And I didn't enjoy that much. But this one was properly good. But I don't think I want to really say too much more about it. I mean, it gets all crazy near the end. There's a lot of politicking involved, as I say. There's a lot of twists and turns. Yeah. And Catherine de' Medici's trying to kill people all over the place. And... you know, get into a lot of things like that. There's an interesting part here, for example, where she sends someone to arrest Henry of Navarre. And she says, and you know, what might happen is he might resist. And the guard says, so you want me to kill a king? And she says, I didn't mention killing anyone, but you got to arrest him. And if he resists, you've got to defend yourself. And the soldier's worried because, of course, she's not going to stand over it when he eventually gets done for regicide, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a lot of that kind of thing. And there's a sad bit where this poor little boy, and he is a boy, and he's a messenger type, you know, a page boy or a groom. And she says she's trying to get information from him, and he won't give up the information. He's a good boy. And she says, what if I give you, like, 10,000 gold pieces or whatever? So she gives him the gold. He gives her the note. And as soon as he walks away, she opens a trap door and just lets him fall and die, and then goes down the stairs and takes the gold back. And she says, this stupid, selfish boy has made me walk down all these stairs to get the gold back now. You know, just total disregard for other people's lives.
She sounds like a charming lady, yeah?
Do you know about Catherine de' Medici? Like, I feel like this is what she's known for.
No, but but I've heard of the Medici family being quite cruel, but not. I don't know too much detail about it. So he's taking liberties on a real family, basically, and just probably exaggerating it, though, right?
I mean, in the TV show Rain on Netflix, which has nothing to do with Dumas, she's portrayed that way as well. She's always scheming. Okay, she's always trying to get control for herself or her sons. She's always, you know, using poisons. And in the TV show, she's also using Nostradamus. So I think a lot of depictions of her are like this.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Well, let me tell you what I've been reading, Dee.
Okay.
I've been reading, I'm just going to get out the book here in a second. I've been reading a great book. I've been really enjoying it. It's called, here you go, what is it? Beyond Psychology. And it's by Osho. It's one of his later books. So I've mentioned him before. Yeah, Beyond Psychology is called. So I mentioned The Way of the Clouds, if you remember, back in September, I think it was.
That rings a bell, yeah.
Yes. And basically about him, that his philosophy is just basically go with the flow. And and basically here, that was an early book of his. And this one is one which he wrote, which he didn't write. It was just recorded and then put into text, as most of his books were. And here he just basically talks about, like, you know, getting beyond the barriers that your everyday life imposes you. He kind of talks about that we use our head too much. That's why kind of like beyond psychology, beyond science, in the sense of beyond like barriers we put ourselves in, that we have a lot more potential than we think.
Okay.
He talks about basically at this point, he's not well loved by the world. He's kind of a persona non grata in most countries, and he's still a very controversial fellow indeed. And I can see why, though. He's very much against just everything, almost. Just he's very much against society, very much against, you know, religion, institution, politics. And he just mentions here that, you know, that basically that people have lost contact with themselves. So he talks about several things. He talks about getting back in contact with nature, for example, that he does like little practices, like going under a tree and spending a lot of time there. Or like walking in the rain, for example, so you can get back in contact with your physical senses, basically.
Okay.
And the book's very interesting. I mean, that's what kind of one of the reasons why he's being portrayed as someone who's kind of sexually deviant, because he is ultimately talking about kind of like, for example, you know, letting go of those barriers as well. For example, what's all this about monogamy, for example, he mentions, because he feels like, well, it's not really what animals do. So it's very much about like getting back to the natural instincts. And also he talks about what I find interesting is shame and feeling guilty and feeling bad about things and feeling like you have to do someone for something. And just he talks about that. That's
just be careful there. Do something for someone.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah. So
just make sure you get those the right way around. We don't
What did I say? What did I say?
Said do someone for something, so we don't want
to... Do someone for something. Okay. Well, anyway,
it's a little bit risky there.
It was getting risky. Well, the whole book is a bit risky. He's a bit risky. But he just talks about, you know, that we should get back into our instincts. We should let go of that feeling guilt. We should go back to our inner child. I find it very influenced by
Nietzsche. You love that. You love that stuff, the inner child.
Yeah, I do love the inner child. So, I mean, but I love the fact that he talks about the way of the clouds. But basically, it's the same kind of philosophy he mentions here again. He does repeat himself often in a good way, I mean, just like reiterating in different stories. And Back in the Way of the Clouds, and in this book, it's very much about, so you've got two kids, and one kid is misbehaving, one kid isn't. One kid is always behaving. And while superficially the one that's behaving very well looks good, and it's like very easy to get along with him, Osho thinks that you're suppressing that, and eventually it will make you sick and a weaker person, morally, okay, even, and physically and spiritually and mentally. At least the kid who's misbehaving, he's at least setting boundaries. It's all about setting boundaries and saying, like, well, you know, this is what society says, but my natural instincts say I should go this way. And rather than it becoming an anarchy, it just becomes a very natural, free-flowing society, according to him, where everyone just basically, when they're really truly in contact with their intuition, cannot be perverse, because perverse is just that you're unnaturally out of contact with yourself.
How do you feel about this? I mean, do you feel that this is helpful to you, like, day to day?
Definitely, yeah. So, I mean, I basically like his books in general. I just read a bit by bit and just meditate on it. I generally just read very slowly nowadays and think about what I'm reading, even in the novels. And I think it's a great help, because stuff like feeling guilty and feeling bad about this or feeling not good enough just brings me ultimately down. So
yeah,
this is there to remind me. More than anything, he's kind of like an author who kind of shakes you awake, a bit like Nietzsche, and just says he can get out of that self kind of pitying, self deprecating, self criticizing state. And basically, that's what the book is. He's very much a scholar, though. That's what people don't realize. He has studied a lot of different practices, and there's a lot of Buddhism, Taoism, Zen Buddhism in there, and even modern Western science, Jungian, Freudian psychology. He mostly does criticize most of these things, but he does come up with some stories and a lot of original material as well. But so he's very much about. He's very much about, like, you know, embracing everything that is there now, including stuff like shouting. I mean, his kind of meditation is more like a meditation where you shout for a while and then you remain silent for a long time. So it's always about extremes rather than like wishy-washy, you know, unsure what to do. So he is very much Kierkegaard-esque, where Kierkegaard also thought it's the decisions that are really important in your life. So the same here, guys, really what you, he's also saying where it's more like what you are and what you do right now, and that you stick to your principles, to your own natural principles.
Okay.
But also at the same time, ironically, he's always very paradoxical. Also at the same time, immediately let go of whatever principles you have and become naked again. So like also be open for like, yeah, maybe I'm completely wrong. So maybe these are my principles. Maybe I'm completely wrong as well. Hmm.
So and since you've talked about it before, the inner child is something that I try to do a lot in my life now. I don't know if I ever actually told you that, since you talked about it before on a previous episode.
You mentioned it. So what do you do then? Tell me.
Just try to keep fun things. Like, just sometimes you just need to be silly. Don't take life too seriously. Just remember the things that bring you happiness, but not even, not just in like a ultimate life happiness. Just like, how can we be happy today? Let's do something fun. It could be something silly. Just have a good time. And I try to do that sometimes, you know?
And he talks about that also. He talks about being that inner child, but like also very much being conscious about that, rather than just, like being conscious, like, okay, I'm doing this in order to like balance out my serious adult side, for example. That can be too dominant, so that kind of pushes you down.
Sure.
Or even kids nowadays behave like adults. So it's all about contrast. You can also be too silly, I suppose.
Sure. Find a balance. Hold on. Breaking news. PJ, you're wearing the bufanda.
Do you not realize this? Of course,
I just noticed. The return of the Bufanda boys.
Le Pink Bufanda. There it is. It's for the Patreon. It's extra payment. Extra. This one's not just on the norm Patreon. You have to get some.
If you go to our Super Ultra Patreon Plus, you can see PJ wearing only the Bufanda.
Oh, I just want it. That's a very expensive price, but
by special request.
Oh, by the way, I do find amusing. Osho is constantly criticized for being someone who says he's spiritual, and then he drives around in limousines and stuff like that, or drinks champagne.
Oh, okay.
This is because he talks about, but he's open. First of all, two things about, he talks about contrast. So he kind of says like, well, I'm just going to do this because I have been meditating for a year, so I'm really going to party hard. And second of all, he purposely provoked people. He was always a provoker. But I like the idea that you rather than just partying sometimes and meditating sometimes, why not go for one extreme to the other? Why not just like meditate and then like feel what it's like to be the complete party goer and just lose your head, like lose your head and then find yourself back. I do like this, you know, it kind of like shakes you. It's kind of like living and dying and then live and then rebirth. There's something very refreshing about it.
I think that's grand, yeah.
So for all your party goers out there, I think you're doing great. I think the problem is, personally, is that people go from one extreme. They stay too long on one extreme. So it's like too much partying or even just too serious kind of academic meditating, just trying
to be perfect. You need a little bit of both. I need to try both to decide which one is really for you as well, I think.
Yeah, exactly. What feels right. It's all about feeling, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of his latter books. He died pretty young, and he's even stopped talking, you know, the last few years. He was a bit mad, you know, but in a good way.
Wow.
Good or bad, whatever it is. He was just mad, but I enjoy that. And this is Beyond Psychology. It's volume one. I don't have the second book, but I do highly recommend it. It's fun to think about.
Before we move on to the next book, there's one thing I forgot to say, which I'd just like to mention real quick. It's not a spoiler as such, but it comes from a little bit near the end of Marguerite de Valois. I just want to give you an example of the type of humor that's also present in the book. And I forgot to mention this. So at one point, a character is arrested. Okay, I'm not going to say who because I don't want to give any spoilers.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, do not let us mistake one another. I saw this figure. So he says, here it is. Isn't this the one you previously seen? It is. Write down that the accused recognizes the statue as the one he has heretofore seen in the possession of someone. He says, no, do not make me a mistake. I said I just saw it. I didn't say there. He says, okay, well, what day did you see it? And he says, the only day that I was ever at Rene's house. He says, you admit then that you were there. He says, well, I never denied it. So he turns to the clerk and he says, okay, write down that the accused admits himself as having gone to Rene's to work certain charms and conjurations. So this is, and he does that the whole way through the proceedings. He'll admit to one small detail. He's like, yeah, I remember seeing him. He's like, write down that he saw him and conspired with him. Like, he's always kind of doing that.
Nice.
And they only get out of a scrape by actually befriending the jailer and bribing, I think, as well. Bribing the jailer and befriending the executioner is, I think, the way to do it.
That's the way to do it.
And there's a funny bit where they mention the crimes that might happen. And he says, you know, we'll cut off your head. And we'll cut down your woods and destroy your chateaus. And he says, as for my head, I knew that that was in jeopardy. But as for my woods and chateaus, I do not fear them in the least. And I defy all your hatchets and pickaxes to burn them, to harm them, sorry. And the judge shouts silence. And he says, moreover. And he says, what? More? You will do something to me after you've cut off my head? So it's kind of funny that, you know.
That's like a witcher.
So the next book... It's time. I feel so selfish, PJ. I talked about a book. You talked about a book. It's time for little Alfred to give his book review of the books he's been reading this month. Okay, well, sadly, Alfred refusing to be part of the show there, not giving us his review. I really had to Instagram post with him this week, and I really, really had to, you know, pressure him to do it. And now he won't even speak on the show.
You're not getting your wage like that, little Alfred. You know what I mean? Like, you know, going on holidays, I feel like you're getting the bigger part of the budget anyway, and you're not even speaking.
Not it's frustrating at times. Well, I'm just going to take off my three bufandas.
You just put on. You just randomly put on more scarves after we talk.
So, I'll tell you a little bit about the next book I read. This, look at this lovely, lovely book here. And when I open it up, it's one of those old leather books and the spine is falling apart when you open it. And this copy was printed in, I believe, 1896.
Wow.
It's a very old copy of the book. And inside it says, dedicated to Charles Dickens.
Does it?
It says, to Charles Dickens, this story is inscribed as a token of admiration and affection by his friend, the author.
Oh, that's right. He was an apprentice, basically, of Dickens, wasn't he?
Yeah. It's Dickens' deputy. Keep calm and read your Dickens. But today we're reading Wilkie Collins. And this book is called Hide and Seek. 1854.
I haven't heard about it at all. Okay.
I had never heard of it either. I must confess. This is one of his
what
early
was the last book you said?
Books.
What was the last book? What was the last book you read from him again?
Well, the last Wilkie Collins, ooh, I don't know. We did Basil, we did No Name, we did After Dark.
I think it was
No Name. And of course, you know, I've read the
anyway, how did you
ones.
Find this one?
I've read The Woman in White and The Moonstone, obviously.
Yeah.
This was fantastic. Right. It's so exciting to find an unexpected Wilkie Collins, you know, in a second hand. I think this is in the Magic Bookshop or somewhere like that, you know. And it's very nice to find. This is a book of two parts, The Hiding and The Seeking. So,
okay.
Basically, we open with a little intro chapter called A Child's Sunday. And it's about this little boy, Zach, and he's got very strict parents.
Okay.
And they're being kind of very mean on Sunday, and they won't let him have anything fun. And they're very, very strict, you know, parenting. No picture books on a Sunday. It's a sin. Go and read your prayer book and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And the boy's like 6 years old or something.
That's pretty good.
So that's where this starts from.
Sounds pretty good to me, to be perfectly weird. Okay. Oh. Well, it sounds a bit depressing so far. So what happens then?
So basically, we have the two halves. So the hiding and the seeking. So the way the hiding starts, we have Zach now grown up. And his father's still a strict educationalist. And he brings some Reverend Yollop in to help him, like, discipline the boy. But he's a young man now. And he wants to do some art. And he has made friends with a very nice chap called Mr. Blythe, who is an artist. Now, this is quite a long book that gives you some of the backstories of things that we don't need to go into, but there's a section on Zach's backstory. There's a section on Mr. Blythe's backstory and him marrying his lovely, I think she's called Livy, his wife, who is bedridden. His wife is disabled and bedridden. And he had a kind of a mean Victorian parent also. But the key thing here is Mr. Blythe is just a lovely champ. He just goes around being kind to everyone, doing his art. And one of the things he does is he goes to the circus and he meets a little girl who's performing in the circus. And she gets her trick wrong and the circus owner beats her. And he says, I fell in love at first
sight. Very Dickensian.
It's very Dickensian. So he says, I fell in love at first sight with a child, and he rescues her from the circus and brings him home and says, you know, now my poor bedridden wife will have a daughter.
The plot's so unrealistic, though. I thought he's supposed to be a realist author.
Well, it's a bit strange because the way they talk about the love would come across as very suspicious and creepy nowadays. They just talk about how this child is so, and she's like 10 years old or something. This girl is so beautiful, and I've just fallen in love with her. And he means like as a father, but it's kind of creepy the way it's written, you know?
Times will change, Thank
you. You just wouldn't say it that way now, but it's fine, you know. He speaks to Mrs. Peckover, who's her kind of guardian, and she says, well, you know, this woman turned up one day, she gave birth, she had the baby, and then she died, and we don't know who the father is. And so this is, like, I've just been looking after her, and my husband's a clown in the circus, so she's just been with us in the circus for 10 years. And then eventually this guy says, well, look, I'm going to take the girl into my home. And the girl's called Mary, but he calls her
nowadays, isn't it? Social welfare. You know, you're not going to have social welfare just some random guy going to the circus. Times certainly have changed.
I mean, it's intended to be an adoption, but there's no formal process here. They just decide, I'll adopt her, and off we go.
But I mean, can you imagine, like, nowadays, someone writing that and bringing that to the publisher and saying, like, oh, this is just realistic? I say, no, it's not going to happen. I don't think this kind of stuff can be even published nowadays, let alone be studied in school.
Probably not, to be fair. But one of the main themes here is that Mary, or as they call her, Madonna, is just extremely, extremely beautiful as she grows up. And, you know, all the men like her and everything else. And she's like, I think she's 21 or something later in the novel. But She's also deaf and dumb, or deaf mute, or whatever the technical, whatever the PC term is nowadays, okay?
Yeah, again, not the kind of phrasing you use nowadays. It's obviously written a long time ago.
Yeah, so she can't speak and she can't hear. Now, she used to be able to until she had an accident falling off a horse and got into shock, in the theatre as part of the mistreatment. And the theatre owner is called a Mr. Jubber or something like that. Yeah, Mr. Jubber. And he's a very Dickensian kind of chap, and he comes in with his hat and his waistcoats and, you know, demands that he get the girl back and makes idle threats and then disappears forever. But it is sort of a book about good people doing good things. You know, they rescue this girl. Blythe's very good. He's very, you know, it's also trying to tell you to patient, this Victorian notion of morality and of patiently dealing with affliction, right? The wife is bedridden and disabled.
That's what
this girl can't speak or hear, but it's just, and you know, go ahead.
No, to be fair, that's a very relevant theme at the time of the Industrial Revolution and shortly afterwards, right? I mean, you know, even the rich people were not in great health, often dying. People didn't always have the education. Yeah, so, I mean, like, it's, there's a reason why English literature at the time talks about it nonstop. Especially in England.
There is, yeah. And that's a big, big theme in the book. It's never explicitly mentioned, but it's always the underpinning. You know, these are the good characters. And there's no real villain. I mean, Mrs. Peckover's nice. Mr. Jubber's a villain, but he disappears. We don't really have a villain, okay? So then we move on to the seeking. And what happens? So they think, you know, this girl Madonna, and they do some art. They sit around by the hearth and, you know, maybe eat some bread and do an evening drawing academy, and they draw together. And it's all very lovely and very wholesome, you know?
Yeah, you would like that kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But then what happens is this chap called Matt arrives from America, and he's a bit of a savage. They say that he's, you know, been tripsing around the Americas and a lot of time in USA, and he's hardened and savage, and he doesn't know polite society. You know, he doesn't know how to speak politely and dress politely. And he sleeps on a rug on the floor and doesn't, you know, use his bed and all this kind of stuff, which I thought was very, very funny.
What a rogue.
And he befriends Zach, and they become instant brothers. Very immediate platonic bond. But we think there's something a little bit nefarious about this guy, because he's very interested in Madonna. Okay. And we wonder, well, is he some relative of hers? Could he even be the father, or what is he? And I'm not going to spoil it, and I'm not going to say what happens. The only thing I will say is the book lacks a real villain, or it lacks real... It's just nice people doing nice things, and sometimes you think things are going to go wrong, but they never really do. You know, it lacks peril.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it's good.
And how would you rate it compared to the other Conan books?
I think it's up there. I think it's just up there with all the good ones. And there's some nice bits here, for example, and I've included this in my notes just because it was funny. Zach and Blythe turn up to the art studio, and they just play leapfrog. They just, for their athletics and their gymnastics, they just leap over each other's backs before starting their painting. And it's just this nice, like, this is how we take our exercise. And they refer to the technical language of leapfrog. This is called a capital back. And they treat like it's some kind of sport, just leaping around over each other. It's very funny.
Right, okay.
But everyone is nice. And we think there's some peril in the seeking, but there's not really.
Nothing ever happens, really. That's like a bit disappointing. I mean, it sounds like the last person is a villain, but not really. Then.
Not really.
Well, no spoilers.
No spoilers. Yeah. But there are twists and turns, and you don't know what's going to happen. And the twists and turns are more figuring out who the people are and how they're actually related to each other, not an actual peril, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Right, okay.
But there are big twists in the story that you don't see coming. And there's the usual horrible, you know, some old Victorian aunt writes her in her, you know, in her will, yeah, someone should read this journal I've written, you know, a defense of my treatment of my niece. Here's why I was just a horrible, horrible person throughout her entire life and let her, you know, live in the streets and starve to death. And I believe I'm morally justified in my conduct. There's a lot of these types of Dickensian people, you know. I would say this book takes place in a Dickens universe. It's very Dickens. It's one of the most Dickensian of Wilkie Collins' books. Because they're not all, so, you know, they're not all Dickensian.
And did he not co-write a book with Dickens as well, to be fair?
I think they co-wrote a lot of short stories and things, and Christmas stories and ghost stories, yeah. And interestingly, this book opens with a prologue where Wilkie Collins says, This was my third book, and for some reason it didn't sell as well as the other two, and I believe it was because of the Crimean War, and then I waited a few years to get it reprinted, and blah, blah, blah. And he's kind of, like, excusing, like, why did this book not do so well? Now, this was before The Famous Ones. This was after Basil, but it was before The Moonstone and The Woman in White. You know, I don't know. I think that he's going to have to set himself up for failure, because apart from, like, two or three books, most of his books, I think, didn't really do all that well.
Yeah, right, okay. Poor chap.
He was just never quite as good as Dickens, but honestly, I think he is a fantastic author in his own right, you know? Certainly better than the Twilights and the 50 Shades of Grey and whatever, you know, trash that your people are reading.
Oh, Dean, hold on a second. Stop. Is it very loud on the bus? Someone's putting on really...
And the only last thing I really want to say about it, you know, just like the last book, we've got nice people, we've got an element of wholesomeness in it. And this girl, they treat her like she's 22 at the end of it, I think, but they still treat her like a child, and she shouldn't go out without someone looking after her, and they're worried about her and all this kind of stuff. And they do treat her like a child. And she draws on a little slate board, but she gets into the art and she draws a nice picture for her friend Zach. And we think maybe there's going to be a love story with Zach, but then that doesn't happen either.
There isn't.
In a sense, really, right. Not a lot does happen in a way. But it's still very nice. But it does also lead into this month's sponsor, because there's a chap in a flashback called a Mr. Carr, and he's a botanist. And they say, it's very strange this young man would be interested in things like flowers. It's not very manly at all. You should really be interested in hunting. And so this month we are sponsored by the Hunting Academy for Botanists. So chaps, if you're a botanist and you want to just learn some hunting instead and be more manly, head over to the botanistshuntersacademy.gov.org.edu and they'll help you right out.
It's the kind of thing that you would do. Oh, Lord.
So
stop the bus, Tom. Stop the bus. That's what my grandmother always said. So it's a very random. I was saying again, stop the bus.
Take your
interpretation of that. Then I'm looking. We might as well tell the listeners. I'm recording this under very unusual circumstances. I was in my classroom at school, teaching in a lovely place, Tafir, Gran Canaria. But I've decided to continue the show in the bus. But I have to admit, someone was being very loud. Perhaps it was me. There was someone now that's putting on very annoying TikTok videos. And I'm now here. It's raining a bit. I'm under my yoga mat, literally under my yoga mat, out in the field. Lovely palm trees. That's a lovely field, isn't it?
It looks lovely, but you're a wild man. You know that.
I'm a wild man, literally under my yoga mat. Very, very fitting, because I was reading a book by a yogi, you know what I mean? Mm. Osho, so there you go. And I thought, open cards on the table. Won't pretend to be in an office today. I don't think I've ever sat in an office for any of our shows. Been ridiculous places altogether.
Well, one time you brought sheep to the show, so that was lovely.
And the grasshoppers, you remember that? A full stack of grasshoppers.
They were less lovely, yeah, but they were there.
Anyway, I'm enjoying the view under my yoga mat. Feeling very much like in the cave, listening to you. Oh, there's rainbow! Look at that!
Oh, lovely! There's a lovely rainbow yesterday as well. Fantastic!
That's a lovely sign. But anyway, continue, Dean.
I only have two more books, so we're gonna finally do a brief episode. But let's take the next one.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.